AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
On the Empire Podcast this week, it's T-Hanksgiving. Yes, we give special T-Hanks as Tom Hanks. Yes, Tom Hanks drops in to talk about Bridge of Spies and the Burbs. I'm so excited. While there's usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast, I can't quite believe the first word of The Force Awakens is this.
What is it?
This.
It's what?
It's this.
The first word is this.
What?
Huh?
And scene, and continue on for forever and ever and ever. It's this, apparently.
This. Is that the first word of the crawl, or the first word of
the first the first spoken word spoken by Andy Serkis? Is this
interesting?
Oh, this.
Spoiler alert!
Oh my god!
Look at us, a new Abbott and Costello. Right, hello pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. That was shambolic, but never mind. As ever, I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning. First up is our geek queen. You've already heard her, a lady who responded, and this is true, to this week's. It's not supernatural this week because you responded to this week's Captain America Civil War trailer the only way she knows how, by sending me Cap and Bucky slash fiction. It was very good. I enjoyed it very much. Helen O'Hara, how are you?
Hello. I would like to make clear this is literally the only piece of fan fiction I've ever read.
All right.
No, true. A friend called Hello Taylor, she has another name, but anyway, on Twitter recommended it once, and I read it, and I'm like, if all fan fiction is this good, why am I not reading more fan fiction? Anyway, so 4 minute window, check it out. But it is, yeah. If you're into Cap and Bucky, it's a Cap and Bucky story.
50 Shades of Buck. So essentially, just, you know, let's give the listeners a little rundown of what happens in that.
It's kind of set after the Winter Soldier, so it's already out of date. You know, Ultron has slightly changed a few things. It's basically Bucky trying to get Cap away from the Avengers so they can live together in love. It's lovely.
It's the greatest love story of our time. next up, we have one of our growing cabal of junior online writers, a mysterious man, a man whose ways are shrouded in shadow, a man who is yet to get an office nickname. It's a man with no nickname, John Nugent. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Yeah, I'm okay.
I mean, if he's that much of a junior, maybe we should just call him Indiana.
Maybe. I was kind of working one this week. I was kind of going, I mean, because we had three entries when I asked for people to come up with a nickname for you. And they were all like, yeah, the new gent and stuff. I don't know.
I mean, John is fine.
No.
I'm happy with John.
No. It's not how it works around here.
Okay.
The nugget? Is that the nougat? Creamy nougat. No, we're back to Buck and Cap again. Okay. Well, we'll work on it. You know, and as ever, if you have any ideas for a nickname for the J Nugel.
No, it's still not happening.
The Nugetron? The
Nugget? No.
The Nugentification 2000? No.
It's like I'm 9 years old again.
Send them in. Use the usual hashtag Emperor Podcast and all that sort of stuff. Right, we have a question, and that question is via Twitter, and that question comes from Metafets, who asks, do you have a favourite movie credit, e.g. Human Toilet Consultant from Duke of Burgundy, or, for example, Jeremy Irons' FISA Miracle Team from Margin Call? So I know the origins of that one. Basically, Jeremy Irons didn't have a FISA in time to work on a Margin Call for J.C. Chandor, and they brought in a team that worked around the clock to make sure he got it so he could come in the movie and do his scary thing.
Hooray!
So, hence that. Human Toilet Consultant, I'm gonna leave that one there. I'm not gonna go into that one. But yeah, favorite movie credits, so kind of weird offbeat stuff. Humorous things are accepted. What we got?
Well, I mean, in terms of humorous things, I highly recommend reading all the credits of the Hot Shots movies, the Naked Gun movies, which are full of interesting little tidbits. There's obviously, you know, the best boy of the film is named, and the worst boy is named as Adolf Hitler.
That's right.
Which is very hard to argue with. He really is quite bad. They also have a lovely brownie recipe. I can't remember which of those films it's in.
I think it's Hot Shots.
I think it's Hot Shots as well. Yeah. But yeah, really tasty brownies. So that's recommended.
I like that they, I think in The Naked Gun, next to gaffer, it says in brackets, what's a gaffer?
Yes, it does.
Which is a good question.
It's a fair question. A lot of people don't know that.
One of the things I love about the Naked Gun movies is that they don't just credit people by their character names. Like, so people, you know, background, you know, supporting players, day players, that sort of thing. They don't just get Man on Train or Cop Number 3. They get the line of dialogue that they had, which I like, because, you know, then you instantly know it. Mm. Whereas if you're looking at the credits going, who was Cop Number 3 again? But you know, here you can use my radio mic. I know who that person is in Naked Gun.
There you go.
There's one for it's Enrico Palazzo, I think, which is the
hey,
best line.
It's Enrico Palazzo!
Confusingly, not actually Enrico Palazzo himself, yeah.
Yes, Mark Holton, who actually went on to star in Leprechaun. Well done, him.
Well done.
Well done. And he's still knocking around. And yeah, this is interesting. Oh, the IMDb is just like a sort of gateway drug, isn't it?
To more IMDb.
He was in an episode of NCIS. I hope he had the same line. I hope that's all he does throughout the rest of his career. He just pops up in movies and goes in movies and TV shows and goes, "Hey, it's Enrico Palazzo."
I wonder how artistically fulfilling that would be.
What if it's all he can say?
I don't think that's likely.
Is it unlikely, Helen?
I'm not a doctor, so I will preface my remarks.
No, you are a fully trained barrister.
I am, but I don't. I'm not aware of any psychological conditions which would make it that he would be able to say one line and no more.
Maybe he was bitten by a radioactive Enrico Palazzo when he was a child, therefore giving him the ability to only say, "Hey! It's Enrico Palazzo!"
I mean, it's a stroke of luck that a film came along that could cast someone with this rare condition.
Yeah, I think that would be the worst superpower ever.
Maybe not. Say, for example, Enrico Palazzo were a real person.
Okay.
Okay? Say, for example, Enrico Palazzo wanted to rob a bank and he was in disguise in the bank. Okay? And the cops didn't know which one it was. Oh, who do we shoot? Along comes Mark Holton, points him out, "Hey, it's Enrico Palazzo!"
Okay, you know what? In that very specific circumstance, which relies like on a lot of things lining up, cosmically speaking, it would definitely be a superpower
that literally anyone else could do. Imagine it, though. Imagine this guy's career. Next up is Mark Holton. He'll be reading for the part of Hamlet. In your own time, Mark. "Hey, it's Enrico Palazzo!"
His agent must be just like, "Mark, you just need to expand your versatility a little bit."
Which Mark obviously replies, "Hey, it's Enrico Palazzo!"
Dude,
Mark, we've been over this.
This guy is still working in Hollywood, 20, 25 years later? You know, he's doing better than any of us.
So he turns up on the set of NCIS.
Yes.
And there he is. He's playing a guy called Sergeant Lynn. And there he is with Mark Harmon.
Oh, amazing.
You know, shooting the shit with Gibbs and Donoso. And then the writer of the show realizes, I have to now write in a character called Enrico Palazzo because that's all this guy will do. He'll literally just point at people and call them Enrico Palazzo. And that's how that episode came about.
I think there was a question we were answering, wasn't there?
I do have
so
a Phil Tippett on Jurassic Park was credited as dinosaur supervisor.
Yes.
This has become a meme.
Yeah.
You know, people have put up pictures of that credit. Yeah. Just saying, you had one job, Phil. People
one
died.
Job.
I mean, he is actually, I think, a very experienced VFX guy.
He's an incredible VFX guy. He's got his own studio.
He worked on Star Wars. Yep. He was one of the big guys behind ILM. And, but yeah, he did not keep hold of the dinosaurs.
He did not supervise them well enough. And in a similar vein, Kyle McCulloch at Framestore was apparently credited as Earth supervisor on Gravity. Well, Kyle, there's still a few problems around here, all right?
That job can be as difficult or as easy as you want it to be. you know, if you take it to be Earth Supervisor, so he's a bit like a Kal-El and he flies around the Earth righting wrongs.
He's in charge of the planet.
That's a tricky job. If your job as Earth Supervisor is to make sure if there's an Earth, that's a fairly easy job. You wake up in the morning and go, yep. Tick. Well, I'm done for the day. I'll be down the pub if you need me, guys.
I suppose there's an element of his job that kind of was that, you know, making sure that the Earth would be there in the background as Sandra Bullock went through her trauma.
I like it. I did a Q&A this week with Edgar Wright about Fistful of Fingers, his very first movie, which came out in 1995 and was given one star by this Frame magazine. The film was running under. Mm-hmm. So it was 74 minutes long, so to make it longer, they made the credits as long as they possibly could. And so the credits are filled with... It's a Sucker-esque spoof, if you've never seen it. Hopefully it's coming out next year. So he did loads of funny jokes in that Sucker-esque... in a Sucker-esque fashion, including the great disclaimer, no animals were harmed during making this movie. They were all killed. Which I like. Also, it's dedicated to Clint Eastwood, Sergio Leone and Derek Griffiths. Which is nice. So that's a good one.
There's a very good piece by Nick on the website with an oral history of that movie, which is very much worth a read if you haven't read it already.
Definitely.
Yeah, it's great. Really, really great. Other good credits. Blofeld in For Much With Love is the actor is credited simply as question mark. Dun, 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 dun. No! Who could it be? Who could it be? I wonder if Christoph Waltz wanted the same thing for Spectre.
It's Luke Skywalker.
Kylo Ren is Blofeld, is Luke Skywalker. Oh, we're falling down the rabbit hole.
I really like Monty Python always messed around with credits at the start The Holy Grail. They've got
the moose. An American Werewolf in London has an end title congratulating Prince Charles and Princess Diana on their recent wedding. Oh yes, it does. That went well. The Beatles' Help was dedicated to Elias Howe, who invented the sewing machine in 1846. Those crazy Beatles.
Oh, and Pixar movies, they always have production babies listed at the end. So all the babies born to Pixar staffers during the making of whatever that movie is get immortalised in the credits, which is pretty sweet.
Because it takes so bloody long to make a Pixar film.
It does, yeah. There were loads on Good Dinosaur, which of course has been in the works for quite some time. This isn't quite a credit in that it's not written down, it's spoken. But I have a very, very big soft spot for Dragnet. I mean, in all sorts of ways, but also because it has the great line, the story you're about to see is true, names have been changed to protect the innocent. For example, George Baker is now called Sylvia Weiss. which is absolutely wonderful.
There's Charlie Kaufman's adaptation, which
of course
was co-written by his fictional brother, Donald Kaufman.
That's true.
Yes.
I think that's the first fictional person ever to receive an Oscar nomination, actually.
The Coen brothers' editor.
I stand corrected. Roderick James.
Roderick James.
Yes.
Now, I'm not 100% sure which nomination came first, but I think Donald Kaufman is the first one to win. You've got to be quite annoyed if you're someone like, say, Leonardo DiCaprio, and you're like, I've been nominated four times, haven't won yet, and yet some dude who doesn't even exist has an Oscar. It seems a little unfair.
It does seem a little unfair. And Mark Holton remains ungarlanded by awards.
This could be the year.
This could be, just imagine his acceptance speech. What would he say? I know what he'd say. He'd say, thank you very much indeed for this Oscar. It means a lot to me. I'd like to dedicate this to Enrico Palazzo! Right, let's move on, because obviously we're not exhaustive. If we've missed anything, if there are any great movie credits, any strange movie credits that we've overlooked or forgotten, then do send them in, and we will try and read them out, if we can, on the show next week. Thank you very much to MetaFets for the question. If you want to have your question read out in the Empire Podcast, send them in via Twitter. We're at Empire Magazine. You can use the hashtag Empire Podcast. You can Facebook us as well, where we're Empire Magazine, of course. And we're on the email, podcast@empireonline.com. Right, it's movie news time. Usually, when a new issue of Empire is out, we do this at the very, very end. We plug it shamelessly at the end of the movie news. But we're going to plug it first, because it's a very, very special issue. And also, it's a very, very special occasion on the Empire Podcast. We've had a lot of new voices in the podcast over the last few weeks. But now we have the newest and the most important. It's the new editor-in-chief of Empire, Terry White. Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Very well.
Can I have a pair of eyes?
No.
Damn it! Terry, you're here to talk about the new issue of Star Wars. I thought I'd slip it in there and see if I could just, you know, subliminally...
That was smooth. Damn really,
it.
Really smooth.
Damn it. We've got the new issue of Empire, which came out this week, and All Good and Evil Needs Agents now. And it's a bit of a belter. What is it about? What's on it? What's so special about this one?
It's a tiny, tiny film that's probably not going to take any money at all called Star Wars, The Force Awakens.
Never.
So this issue has been 2 years in the making between the filmmakers and the whole Empire team. And it's pretty much probably the greatest issue of Empire probably we've ever done, and definitely the greatest Star Wars issue you will be able to find. Not overstating it at all.
Straight in with the hyperbole. I like it. This will change your life.
It will change your life. The lives of your children, the lives of your relatives, even your dead ones.
Well, I'm just flicking through it now. My political views have changed. It's quite amazing.
Comes with a cure for cancer as well. Yeah.
Do you feel like a different man? A richer man?
No, because you just let me a pay rise, but... But I feel happier, I feel more content.
Good.
So what's in the issue? Why should people pick it up?
So, I mean, it's got the usual incredible access you'd expect from us at Empire. So obviously we speak to JJ, everybody involved with making the film, incredible exclusive interviews with both people who've been with the franchise for years, Harrison Ford, Mark Hamill. And then you've also got obviously all the amazing new talent that's attached to it. So John Boyega, Daisy Ridley, Adam Driver, Gwendolyn Christie. It really is every single person who's been involved in making this incredible movie. Mm-hmm. We've spoken to Simon Pegg has written an amazing piece about his relationship with Star Wars through the years, and this for me is what really shines through in this issue, is everybody has a story about Star Wars. Everyone has a love and an emotional connection with Star Wars, and you get that from every single person we spoke to, and it's really, really sort of comes to the fore in Simon's piece, which is about his lifelong love affair with Star Wars. The very first time he saw it, I actually got a tear in my eye and I have a dead heart when I read his piece. And yeah, it's a really, really incredible issue, and it's so rich. Everything basically you want to know is in there. Everybody who has a love for Star Wars will find something they connect with in this issue, and if anybody leaves it with a dry eye, they can come and see me personally.
That's not a good idea. Don't say that. Yeah.
Or address it. No.
But there are other things as well to talk about the issue. I mean, the covers are astonishing.
Yeah, so we really went to town on the issues. We did 6 lenticulars, which is a fancy word for 3D. And yeah, they really look incredible. And then alongside that, we also with Sainsbury's did a special deal where you can get a figurine. It's a slightly higher price. It's $11.99, but essentially you get an incredible Kylo Ren figurine plus a boxed issue of Empire. Mm. So yeah, so it's probably the most ambitious thing we've ever done. Yeah. It was done with the filmmakers. It's the first time we've ever done anything of this scale, and it really just shows how much we love this movie, how much we know how all of our guys love this movie. So yeah, I'd urge everybody to pick it up.
Yeah, it's fantastic. The action figure thing is extraordinary.
Yeah.
We had one in the office and I was playing with it today. I didn't take it out of the box and play with it.
Never take it out of the box.
That's, if I'd known that as a kid.
Haven't you seen Toy Story 2? Come on, people.
Honestly, if I'd known as a kid,
Kylo Ren,
I wouldn't be here. Because I had so many Star Wars toys. And if I'd kept them in their boxes pristine, I could have been... I'm probably a multi-millionaire by now, but it was, you know.
Yeah.
So the covers are Kylo Ren. There's a great Kylo Ren one. There's Daisy Ridley as Rey.
So there's Rey and BB-8. There's Captain Phasma, Finn, Poe Dameron, Kylo Ren, and then a Han Solo and Chewbacca, which is
my favorite color
because incredible.
My favorite Star Wars character is on the cover. Chewbacca. I'm very, very excited about it. But there's other stuff in there as well for people who maybe the weirdos who don't like Star Wars. So there's a great Burt Reynolds feature.
Yeah, incredible. Nick DeSemelin went and spent a few days with him in Florida. He now runs this acting school.
With Bert's permission. He wasn't living inside the walls of Bert's house.
He was in a bush outside Bert's house. He had full permission to do so. It's incredible. It's a real portrait of, you know, a man who has had an incredible career in Hollywood. Really great feature. There's exclusive looks at Zoolander 2, mm-hmm. Fantastic Beasts, Grimsby, great set report from Sherlock. And then there's just some great end of year stuff. So review of the year, mm-hmm. Christmas gift guide, and Star Wars does dominate, but we also do have an incredible feature where we went and spent 4 days on the set of Hateful Eight.
Yeah.
Basically on the hunt for Quentin Tarantino. I won't tell you if we found him because that would be spoiling it for you. So yeah, it's a cracking issue. And I don't just say that because I'm pissed.
And of course, it's your second issue now.
It is.
How are you finding Empire? You can tell us, we're doctors.
You're all really lovely.
The rest of them out there. Yeah.
Those people outside who can't hear us, awful human beings.
Not to create a schism in the team, but those guys suck.
Must fire all of them. No, it's amazing. I mean, it really is. You know, before I worked here, it was a very long held ambition of mine to do so. It's truly the greatest film brand in the world. Anywhere you go, people love Empire. I was in a cab in LA last week and I told the guy what I did and he was American and it's actually really hard to buy it unless you get the iPad version, and he spent 20 minutes driving down Sunset shouting at me about what an amazing magazine Empire was. So
you were clawing at the door handle.
I was in the boot, which made it quite awkward.
So, you know, it's early days yet, but not to give too much away, but you know, what are your plans for Empire? What have you got in store?
Well, I think we're in a really interesting place in terms of what I'd call screen entertainment. And, you know, it's never been more accessible. People are watching more than ever. You know, the influence of things like streaming, the ways and the means by which people can see movies and amazing cinematic television have never been more exciting or greater. So I think we'll probably see a little bit more exploration into that world. But I mean, really, I've totally landed on my feet here. I've inherited this incredible film magazine that gets the greatest access to the greatest people, written by the greatest writers and edited by the greatest editors in the business. So I think don't break it, really, is my aim. But I think we'll have some really interesting things going on in terms of bringing film to life, I suppose, is what I'd say. So working on doing cool events, basically doing screenings, things like that, which really bring film to the guys out there. And people should really watch out for those things because we will be taking Empire into the real world.
Well, should I dust my coat off? It's quite cold out there.
It is. I'll bring the gloves and scarves.
Okay. All right. And, you know, you're a massive, huge film fan. I mean, some of the things I'm discovering about you as over the last couple of months, is you're a massive John Waters fan?
I am, yes.
Is he like the one for you?
In what sense?
Well, you know, you're here like Sam Raimi in a romantic way, you know, yeah. Just both throwing on the pencil moustaches and going out for the evening. You know, Sam Raimi is my hero. Is John Waters yours?
He is, yeah. And I interviewed him a couple of years ago in New York and he was everything you would hope he would be. You know, he was doing really interesting things in New York on the underground when he was really doing something incredibly different. You know, he talked to me about getting the bus from Baltimore, sneaking to New York, all the amazing things he saw there. He told me about how he saw a hooker do a shit in the street and how it really upsets him that that doesn't happen in New York anymore. I was like, you are going to the wrong places. But, I mean, you know, his really early, early stuff, you watch it now and it's, you know, it's hardly maybe the greatest films, especially his short stuff. They're hardly the greatest films in the world, but they're really interesting, and you can see as an auteur exactly his style and what he has in mind, and he's just all about breaking boundaries, doing really provocative stuff. Even, you know, people often talk about Crybaby and Serial Mom and those being kind of him moving towards the mass market, but they're still mental, like absolutely mental. I love Pink Flamingos, huge fan of Divine. I think their collaboration and their creative partnership was incredible. And when I spoke to him, you could tell how much he really missed Divine and missed the magic they brought together on the screen, you know. And he told me this amazing story about the first time he met Divine. And Divine was stood by the side of the road waiting for the bus to school. And he drove past and he was like, the fuck is that? And immediately knew he had to make this person his friend. And they did some incredible, incredible stuff together. The BFI recently ran the John Waters season. Mm. And seeing those things on the big screen at, you know, this amazing venue, and you've got this audience of people watching Pink Flamingos and watching, you know, Divine Eat Dog Shit. And it's just, it's still every time I see it, and especially seeing it on the big screen, it just brings me out in goosebumps every time.
And he's actually the limited edition subscribers cover at this point.
Yeah. So also, dog shit, free with every issue of Empire.
That would be the last issue of Empire ever. It would be just, what a way to bow out. Just dried or, you know, as it is in the film, you know, runny and fresh.
Well, I think, you know, if you're going to commit, if you're going to commit, it has to be fresh. No?
Precisely. Yeah. Precisely.
I guess.
Come on, people.
Yeah. Honestly, prudes.
Yeah. You're so square. But actually, I mean, I have to say, my love of film was kind of born early by... I had this real taste for brutality when I was really young. So when I was 8, my favourite film was Scum. And I'd got it on video from a boy at school, and I started to just watch it. Video, by the way, for everybody who doesn't know, is what used to happen before the internet. And it was... I can remember just watching it and being like, this is amazing. So amazing. And when my mum would go out, I'd just play it over and over again, like, and I became obsessed with that and The Craze with the Kemp twins, which is not my finest moment. Please,
this is really putting your issue meetings in a new light. This,
yeah.
This explains everything, why you come in with a sock full of snooker balls
and a samurai sword
yelling, I'm the daddy.
Yeah, I'm the daddy now, Chris. And then my and it's all, I've always had, I think, a taste for beautiful brutality is what I call it. So then I moved to Cares, which was slightly more poetic, arguably. And my favourite film is Godfather 2, closely followed by True Romance. So if there isn't one scene of gratuitous violence in a movie, I tend to be incredibly disappointed.
You have come to the right place. Not because there's no gratuitous violence in the Emperor podcast, obviously, but, you know,
obviously.
We don't get on that sort of thing. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming in and plugging the magazine.
Thank you for having me.
It is a cracking issue. That was The Soothing Strains of Terry White, the new editor-in-chief of Empire. Yeah. Brutality and swearing.
And dog shit.
But I didn't get a pay rise. Damn it. I'll work on that.
2 out of 3.
Our door is always open. Right, should we talk about movie news? Problem, of course, this week is that it's T-Hanksgiving in the American states.
That's true.
So, not a lot of movie news out there.
Not a huge amount, but the important thing is that there was a Captain America Civil War trailer.
What?
Yes.
Oh my God!
Squee!
Squee indeed. So if you, I mean, obviously podcast not the right forum to talk about trailers, what with being oral, not visual. However, I do recommend very much watching it as at your earliest convenience. This one...
Hey Helen, do you know what I also recommend?
What's that?
I recommend going on to EmpireOnline.com and checking out our exclusive trailer breakdown.
With the Russo brothers.
Where I talk to the Russo brothers.
Yes.
Joe, Anthony and Simon.
Let's just stop after Anthony.
Let's just stop after Joe and Anthony.
Yes, lovely men.
Yeah.
Very, very smart. Very, very clued up. Know exactly what they're doing with this film. And as someone who was on set might have said, if they weren't embargoed.
Who could that person possibly be, Helen?
I don't know. Anyway, theoretically. But this is a film that... I think we're all very excited about it. I hope we're all very excited about it. I think it's going
John?
To be really good.
Yes. Are you excited about it?
I am. This is one of the rare comics that I've actually read, so I am very excited about this.
Of course, it's going to have very little to do with that storyline.
Yes.
That, right?
Well, the trailer shows a lot of Bucky. Like, that seems to be a big thrust.
I think...
Right?
Ooh, that's an interesting choice of words.
I think Bucky is going to be a bit of a flashpoint here. I think
well,
it's
that's
clear...
an interesting choice of words.
Yeah. I think it's clear from the end of The Winter Soldier. I don't think I'm giving anything away here or
well,
telling
that's an
tales
interesting choice of words.
Oh, come on. Just stop it now. Let's just assume everything is a euphemism.
Okay.
So it was clear from Winter Soldier.
The big climax
of The Winter Soldier, where Bucky really went to town on Steve. Well, he did. He really gave him a pummeling.
Yeah.
He did. He pummeled him with his mighty fist.
That's right.
But
it was clear by the end of that film, when he pulled him out of the water, that he was beginning to maybe remember slightly who he was and slightly overcome his conditioning. Now, if we've also seen, and I think we all have, the Ant-Man post-credit sting, we'll know that Steve and Sam find Bucky. We saw him, you know, Steve has been looking for him. We know that from that throwaway line in Avengers. We know from Ant-Man that he's found him, which will appear a slightly different version of that scene is in this film. It's going to be a little bit sort of into the film as they establish to you, Chris. And that is going to be, I think, a big problem for everyone else, because obviously the Winter Soldier has a rap sheet a mile long, and has been causing all sorts of chaos around the world, not to mention that whole thing with the helicarriers falling on Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. So he's going to be in a little bit of trouble if he turns up. And equally, we can be pretty sure that Steve isn't going to feel he's responsible, what with the whole brainwashing thing.
Yeah, so the story, as far as I understand it, of Civil War, in the comics, the government wanted to introduce superhero registration.
Yes.
Because of a massive event, a bad event involving Speedball,
mm-hmm.
which left several hundred people dead.
Yes, many children
as well.
Children as well, indeed. But in this, it's very, very different. From what I'm guessing, the event that actually sparks off the idea of superhero registration in this movie is Age of Ultron.
Yes.
And Ultron trying to drop
a city
onto the world. But luckily, Earth supervisor.
Kyle McCullough.
He was there. And he stopped it. He went, "No, don't do that, Ultron." Deleted scene.
Oh, okay.
So it didn't happen. And so that sparks off the government, in this case personified by General Thaddeus Thunderbolt Ross, played by William Hurt. Remember me from The Incredible Hulk. Yes, I'm back. Rent it if you want. He's back.
Yes.
And so he wants to introduce something called the Sokovia Accords, which essentially means superhero registration, that vigilantism is no longer going to be tolerated. And so this a line is therefore drawn. I think this is directly related then to something Bucky does. So Steve Rogers, Captain America, says no to superhuman registration. Screw you, government. I'm going to go off on my own and do my own thing. And then he's up against a very interesting nemesis in this one. Who is it, Helen? Who's he fighting? Who says yes to superhero registration?
Tony does.
Tony Stark.
A.K.A. Iron Man, again, yes. If we're being formal. So, yeah, so the idea is, I think, that he was first suffering a little bit of post-traumatic stress after the events of the first Avengers. We saw that a little bit in Iron Man 3. And then in Age of Ultron, of course, it's all his fault. And while he doesn't immediately, outwardly sort of take responsibility for that when challenged, I think he's one of these guys who kind of thinks about it a little bit and then realises, oh dear, I really screwed up and I should probably fix that. So the idea is that this is that, he has reached that point now. And so he is now trying to essentially make up for past mistakes by supporting this Sokovian Accords, which, I mean, and it is one of these things where there's a little bit needs of the many, needs of the one thing here, because I think the implication from what we've seen so far is that Steve is perhaps not being as reasonable as he might be if Bucky weren't involved.
Yes.
And that the basic idea of regulating the use of incredibly destructive powers is not a bad one.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see kind of where Tony's coming from on this as well. So I think that's the interesting thing. There are sort of antagonists in this movie. Obviously, Thunderbolt. We know that Daniel Brühl has been cast as Zemo, so we can imagine he probably won't be the nicest man in the world. We know that Frank Grillo's back as Crossbones. We know he isn't a terribly nice guy. But I don't think the focus of the movie is going to be on a baddie, per se. I think the focus of the movie is going to be on, essentially, brothers going to war. Oh my God, I'm so excited.
Yeah, I showed this to my wife last night. It's the most exciting thing I've showed to my wife in many a while. And she was, it's interesting because she's a big fan of the Marvel films, but she's not, you know, more of a casual observer rather than, you know, you and I who are mostly invested with these people we've never met.
What if something bad happens to them, Chris?
But she, you know, she was really excited about it. You know, the idea of Tony and Steve clashing is a new wrinkle. I think, and we've talked about this in the podcast before, but I think the development of Tony Stark from Iron Man, the very first hero we saw in the Marvel Universe, a man who has been, quite frankly, from the off, in plain sight, a dick, but a brilliant one. The evolution of that character to, I'm not really the bad guy in this, but to someone who will take an antagonistic stance and be very different from Tony Stark we saw back in 2008. I think that's really clever, and I think it's really good character building. I hope they pull it off.
I would agree, and I think that the character building of Captain America has been incredible as well. Going from the very idealistic kid that we saw at the beginning of the first Avenger to the really suspicious, scarred, wary guy in the Winter Soldier, and I think that has only been amplified more since then. That's fascinating.
Well, as Joe Russo says in the trailer breakdown, they wanted to take him from a rah-rah, flag-waving patriot, which he was obviously in the first Avenger, to essentially, at the end of this movie, an insurgent, which is a hell of a character development for a man called Captain
America. He's never been a thoughtless patriot.
No,
he's always
been
a very considered patriot, and I think that's something we could do more of in the world today. So it's great. Oh, I love him.
Let's save all this discussion for our spoiler special next May. But let's talk about the trailer itself, because the trailer is very interesting. Because first and foremost, it's a Captain America trailer, and I think a lot of people looked at this movie when it was first announced, and Civil War, and the idea that, you know, the Avengers would be in the film when it was confirmed that the likes of Vision and Scarlet Witch and Hawkeye and Black Widow all be in the film. Now they thought it would be just Avengers 2.5, which even Anthony Mackie said at one point.
Yeah.
It is. It doesn't seem to be that at all. It seems to be Captain America, and at some point the Avengers will come into it and choose sides.
Yeah.
But
that's the impression I
get
as
Tony,
well.
Tony, Steve and Bucky seems to be the story here.
I think Tony is a supporting role out of those three. I think it's going to be more Steve, Sam and Bucky.
I got the impression that they were holding quite a lot back for this trailer.
True.
That they didn't want to reveal too much, that they didn't want to spoil anything. I know at Comic-Con there was a longer trailer that had more footage with Ant-Man and Black Panther. And we don't see any of those. We see a little bit of Black Panther, I think. But the full lineup of the Avengers fighting is not really revealed here, so I get the impression almost that we're only seeing bits from the first or second acts.
I think we're seeing stuff that's in the third act, but it's just not clear what's where.
Yeah.
But I do think that they're holding back, and I think there may be, you know, some of those kind of splash pages with, you know, five people in a line running at other people in a line. I'm pretty sure they're deliberately leaving some people out of that lineup.
Which we've never seen in the MCU to date. We've seen people fight. We've seen, obviously Hulk will fight anyone, so will Thor. But we haven't seen that before, that the two teams of heroes having to go at each other, which is in a power kind of way.
can we talk about that, and no euphemism intended here, the three-way at the end of the trailer?
Uh-huh.
That got everyone excited, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, because it's Cap and Bucky sharing the shield.
Yeah.
And using it to beat up Iron Man.
Yeah.
Because on paper, that's not a fair fight. On paper, Iron Man just goes, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, you're gone. Okay.
But
the shield and they're...
With the shield and also the fact that I think it's clear that he's holding back a bit, because there was a tweet from Devin Faraci yesterday when the trailer first came out, which I thought nailed it, which is Batman v Superman makes it look like everyone hates each other, whereas the Civil War trailer makes it look like everyone loves each other, and then, they're still fighting, and that's a far more interesting fight, actually.
I think for me the key moment in the trailer is not and apologies if you don't like Marvel discussion, but we haven't done this for a while podcast. The key moment for me in the trailer is not the three-way fight at the end, is not the appearance of Black Panther, is not, oh look, it's a team of Avengers versus Rhodey and War Machine. The key moment for me is when Steve says to Tony at the end of the trailer, I wouldn't do this if I didn't have any other choice. He's my friend. And Tony says, looking ultra pissed, so was I.
I don't think he's pissed there. I think he's upset.
I think he's pissed. He's upset. I think it's everything. I think, you know,
he looks heartbroken.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm really intrigued to see what happens. I wasn't on set. I don't know anyone in this room who was.
the idea.
But, you know, I'm just really intrigued to see how the build up to that, and of course the aftermath of this film, and what this means for the MCU and what this means for these characters with Avengers Infinity War looming large. I'm very, very excited about it. I read one tweet yesterday from an American film critic who was critical of the tone of the trailer being very ultra serious, and I didn't go back and look at the trailers for The Winter Soldier, but I imagine they were also ultra serious. But we know from the Ant-Man clip that played at D23 where Paul Rudd is introduced to Steve Rogers and is just Scott Lang is introduced to Steve Rogers and is just utterly awestruck, and you know there will be humor in this film, but I think it's Captain America, and The Winter Soldier was quite a dark film, and it's heading in that direction. I think Ant-Man was light. Guardians of the Galaxy was light. I think that the MCU has earned the right to have the darkness in amongst the fun.
I mean, there's an arguably funny line about, you know, you seem defensive, Cap. Well, I'm having a bad day.
Yeah.
You know, there's
and
a little
I
bit
I want to
of...
punch you in your perfect teeth.
Yeah.
You know, all that sort of stuff. You know.
Isn't it good that Cap has perfect teeth, given how poor his circumstances when growing up? So he really must have taken care. Well done, Cap.
I think it's a metabolism thing.
The MCU is good at
creating moments of levity, even in its more serious films. I mean, you know, The Winter Soldier has some really funny moments, and that's probably its most serious film, I suppose.
Think we can rely on Falcon, actually, a little bit for that.
Yeah, and quite frankly, even though Tony Stark is going to be positioned as a force of opposition in this movie, Robert Downey Jr. cannot not be funny. You know, he will be funny in this film. But as the Russo said, I mean, go and read the Twitter breakdown. You know, obviously there's some stuff they didn't want to talk about. There's some stuff they didn't go into. But they were very interested, I think, on a lot of things. And they say that Downey's performance in this movie is risky. He goes to risky places. And weirdly enough, when I talked to him, Downey, for the Avengers Age of Ultron feature last year, we talked for quite a bit about Captain America Civil War, because I was really intrigued by, you know, this guy who has been the figurehead of the Marvel Universe so far, who re-upped his deal just to appear in this movie, which doesn't have Iron Man in the title. Obviously has Iron Man all over the marketing materials, but, you know, his name won't be first for the first time in a Marvel movie. Probably be and Robert Downey Jr., I'm guessing. And I thought it was really intriguing that he would appear in this movie. And I asked him why, and he said, well, you know, because the story demands it, and because it's really intriguing to see what they're doing with Tony. And he said the same thing you said. He said, it's not so much Tony's development that is why I did this movie. It's Steve's. And that character and what they're doing with this character is really, really interesting. So, Helen and I are fully paid up members of the Marvel fanboy and fangirl club. We all know that. But yeah, very, very exciting trailer for us. John, where do you stand on the Marvel thing?
I certainly don't stand on it. I mean, you don't want to mess up those pristine copies. But I was never a big comic book fan growing up. So I don't have that sort of that childlike nostalgia. But they haven't really put a foot wrong in the films. One or two duds, but it's an unbroken run, isn't it? So I can't see this being a bad film. It'd be very surprising if it was.
I'd be amazed.
Fingers crossed. Let's move on now to some non-Marvel news. You can take your earmuffs off now. What have we got?
I'm going to suggest that we possibly touch on briefly the first official image from Wonder Woman.
Yeah, okay.
Let's balance the books a little bit by talking DC. There isn't much to say about this. This is a picture of Wonder Woman in a hood, wearing a sort of, what do we call that? It's not a tiara, I wouldn't say. But anyway, wearing a headdress.
Yeah, what is that?
It's a thing. It's just a thing. And she's in foggy London. I think I take from it that she's meant to be. And this is part of the World War One bit of the film. We know that there's a section in World War One. And if you saw the initially posted and swiftly deleted picture of Chris Pine and Segta Mooney, you'll see.
I did not see that.
You did not?
Well, I did not see that, no.
He was in what looked to me like a sort of, World War One kind of doughboy-esque costume. So I think that might also be from the same bit of the film. So maybe that's a bigger part of this film than we have been led to believe. Who knows?
Steve Trevor,
yes.
Played by Chris Pine.
Yeah.
So you think it's going to be a bit like Captain America, the first Captain America, where it takes place, it's a period film, and then...
We're being told it takes place in three different places. We're being told that there's the section in her home of Themyscira, and then there's also a World War One section, and then there's also a modern day section. Now, that's a heck of a lot of sections, frankly. So I don't quite know how that's going to work, but apparently that's the deal. And it does also mean, I mean, how does Steve Trevor move from World War One? Maybe he doesn't. Maybe he's the Peggy Carter of this story.
Maybe.
And he stays back there and she moves on.
Forgive me, because I've never read any of these comics. Is Wonder Woman immortal or something? Does she...
She was formed from the living clay by the Queen Hippolyta of the Amazons, who live on Themyscira. They are a female society.
Like you didn't know that?
I mean, obviously. they're to all intents and purposes, I guess, sort of immortals. But yeah, her origin story has changed and been fiddled with, as all origin stories have over time, but that's the general one, yeah.
Interesting.
So it's filming now in London with Gal Gadot
as
Wonder Woman. And we're going to see her soon in Batman v Superman, Cool on Dawn of Justice. So
the film features, as we've discussed, Gadot, Pine, Tagmoe, Robin Wright, Danny Houston, David Thewlis, Elena Anaya, and Lucy Davis. That's a good lineup. And Patty Jenkins, obviously, directing.
Indeed. David Thewlis.
I wonder if
he gets decapitated.
Really dark.
It's
dark
a given.
Question.
It's a given.
Yeah, anyway, so fingers crossed it can deliver as hard as we all hope. In other news, we're going to be talking about Black Mass in a minute, but the director, Scott Cooper, has signed up for a new film called White Knight. So he's going from Whitey Bulger and Black Mass to White Knight. I'm sure there's a colour joke here somewhere. I'm just not sure what it is. No,
is there?
Probably not.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, he obviously did well with Crazy Heart. Then he made Out of the Furnace. And now he's made Black Mass. And so White Knight is apparently the story of a former Secret Service agent who takes a job protecting the family of an arms dealer and then finds himself at the centre of a global manhunt. It's probably his own fault for working with freaking arms dealers. But, you know, hey, that's the deal.
Hey, Tony Stark was an arms dealer.
I know. And look what happened.
So a few months ago, Kenneth Branagh announced that he was going to produce and direct a remake of Murder on the Orient Express, in which a murder takes place on the Orient Express.
Agatha Christie. Thanks for clarifying.
Yeah. Agatha Christie, Hercule Poirot mystery. And we all wondered at the time who Kenneth Branagh would get to play Hercule Poirot. And now he has scoured the earth.
He has.
He has gone from pillar to post. He has left no stone unturned.
It's like Scarlett O'Hara all over again, except more so. He has hunted and hunted.
And eventually he found the person who is the perfect Hercule Poirot.
The only real choice.
The only choice. And that person is
Kenneth Branagh.
Amazing.
It's amazing he was available. I mean,
well, Mark Holton read for the part, but how do you jazz it up? Maybe a murder doesn't take place. Maybe it's not on the Orient Express. Maybe Poirot did it. Who knows? Who knows?
I've always had my suspicions about him and Miss Marple and indeed Jessica Fletcher. They turn up at a country house for a nice weekend with their friend and suddenly there's a murder? Come on.
Yeah.
Once, maybe, but this goes beyond coincidence.
It's a little suspicious.
I think they're like Dexter. They're just actually mass murderers.
Yes, it's the only thing that makes sense. And then they just kind of manipulate these patsies to take the fall for them.
These people have got blood in their hands.
A lot of blood.
The only detective we know who doesn't kill people is Columbo.
Obviously, Columbo.
Because we see
wouldn't.
The people kill at the beginning of the thing.
Also, Columbo would never. He's an angel.
He is an angel.
Literally.
And that is true, Helen, in more ways than one. So anyway, Hercule Poirot is Kenneth Branagh, or Kenneth Branagh is Hercule Poirot.
Hercule Poirot.
Hercule Poirot. I'm really intrigued by this. We were really excited about this whenever, because, you know, as much as we get excited about the big franchise films, you know, there's a lot of them. And it's nice to see one that isn't a franchise film, although this will probably launch a Poirot franchise.
Yeah. It's been a while.
Yeah. But I think he's a good choice. I just really want to know the process that led to that choice.
Probably him just making up a shot list and deciding whether he could be bothered.
Yeah, probably.
I'll be interested to see what accent he goes for, because it's obviously Belgian, right?
It's Belgian. Yeah. It has to be Belgian.
And I don't know if you saw Jack Ryan, but his Russian accent was...
What do you mean? Your Russian accent good.
That was the only thing that got murdered in that film.
Amazing. Am I right in thinking, last time you came in here, you launched some sort of campaign against Jon Favreau?
Come on.
And now you're adding Sir Kenneth Branagh to your list of conquests.
Sir Kenneth, national treasure. Yeah. Branagh.
You're talking to two Northern Irish people and you're dissing Sir Kenneth Branagh.
I'm not apologising for that. Jack Ryan, his accent is...
Well.
It's sub Blofeld.
Where do you get off? Who do you think you are, Nugent? No, it's not a nickname. It's his actual surname. Where does this hate come from, man?
No, I love Ken. I love Ken.
Hey,
you're backtracking now.
Own it. Yeah. Own the hatred. I'm very excited about it. And I'm sure his accent will be very good.
I have no doubt.
Who are you going to hate next time?
I don't... I'm a lover, not a hater.
Yeah. I'm not so sure. Any more movie news? Are we good?
Think we
are
can
we
leave
out?
It there. We're out.
We're out of movie news. Okay.
Well, there is...
There is another.
It's TV news. Ooh, First poster for Game of Thrones season
six. I saw this.
Came out this week. Jon Snow is on the first poster for Game of Thrones season six. And that is a big deal if you have seen Game of Thrones. If you haven't seen Game of Thrones, or if you're not caught up, then we won't say any more than that. But it is a big deal. Mm-hmm. He's seen bloodied and on the poster.
Yeah.
Mm. And just that in itself is substantial.
And it says simply April, which is a mistake because that's not even his name. Okay, let's have a guest. Let's have this week's guest. It is T. Hanksgiving. So let's give T. Hanks. He's a ruddy legend. He was one of the world's biggest movie stars in the 1980s and the 1990s and the noughties. And just for good measure, he remains one of the world's biggest movie stars in whatever the hell we're calling this period. What is it? The teens? The tens?
I guess, the tenties?
The tenties?
Oh, dear.
I like
no.
that. Like no. that. He's the star of Splash, The Money Pit, The Burb, Saving Private Ryan, Philadelphia, Forrest Gump, Captain Phillips, Dragnet. I'm missing quite a few. He's made more than those films. He's reteamed with his old pal and our former editor Steven Spielberg for their fourth movie together, Bridge of Spies, which is out this week. He is, of course, the great Tom Hanks. I spoke to him recently about that film, about the man he calls El Jefe, and I asked him a question that I've wanted to know the answer to for the last 26 years, Helen.
Wow.
I feel old.
Yeah, it's probably longer
That's
than John's
been
alive.
Almost as old as I am, yes.
Get the fuck out. I mean, enjoy the Tom Hanks interview. We're delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by Tom Hanks. How are you, sir?
I'm very good. Good to see you.
Good to see you. And Bridge of Spies is a fantastic film. And it opens, it takes place in a period of history that started around about the time you were one.
No, I was born in 1956.
Yeah.
The arrest and defense of Rudolph Abel, yeah. Mm. I actually think that was slightly before I was born.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and then we compress everything. Actually, we don't specifically say these things happen one after another. We just let time go by without putting up one of those title cards that say 4 years later. We just took that out.
There are little mentions every now and again. You can hear 1960 being said and, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. But for example, you were 1 year old. Unless you were a particularly prodigious child, I imagine this is something that you learned about much, much later in life.
Well, I was cognizant of the Cuban Missile Crisis when it happened, because my parents were talking about it quite a bit. And we saw in the newspapers what cities were within range of the missiles from Cuba. And I was aware of Nikita Khrushchev proclaiming, "We will bury you," at one point. And he was talking about economically and intellectually and technologically. But to the mind of a 4, 5, 6 year old, that means he's going to dig a hole, throw us in it and put dirt over us. So the fact is, growing up, the Cold War was on the news every night. Some form of it was some comment on the Soviet us versus them, the Soviet Union here, Red China there, was part and parcel to the news media growing up, the discussions in social science classes at school, and the inevitability of a conflict between us and them was discussed all the time. I mean, not just to the point of duck and cover and air raid shelters and, you know, atomic fallout. There was a kind of credence given over to the hypothetical. I mean, there was, like, for example, did you have the Twilight Zone over here?
We did.
Okay, so yeah. there was an amazing, and I will say I remember seeing it as a kid. I probably didn't. But there's a great Twilight Zone episode that had Charles Bronson, okay, and Elizabeth Montgomery, who went off to play Samantha the Witch and Bewitched later on.
Yeah.
She had no lines, and Charles Bronson, and they were veterans, survivors of two opposing armies in a bombed out city that was somewhere in the future. And you thought that they were going to find each other and kill each other. And instead, Charles Bronson screamed at her, "I don't want any more of your war, go away." And at the end, Charles Bronson has put on a civilian suit and he's wearing a tie without a shirt on. And he walks and he sees the enemy soldier across the street, and it's her. And he doesn't know if he's going to have to pull out his gun and shoot or not. And instead, she shows herself coming up from behind a bombed out car, and she's wearing a dress, you see. So now, and that took place in World War III, you see. Star Trek made references to World War III. And so all the time that I was growing up, this was something that was going to happen, and it was going to happen in our lifetimes. And it was inevitable because communism said that we will take over the world. The whole Lenin, the whole aspect of Leninism was it can't really come into play until the entire world is a workers' paradise.
Yeah.
So I will say that as soon as I became some aspect of being cognizant of the way the world worked, World War III and us versus them was part of it.
But this story, the specifics of this story, Rudolph Abel and James B. Donovan, is that something that you became aware of when the script landed on your desk, or were you aware of this before?
We were aware, I very much knew the story of Francis Gary Powers and the U2 aspect. I knew that he was returned somehow. I knew nothing about James B. Donovan. I knew nothing about Rudolph Abel. I knew nothing about the particulars of it. So in that case, as a matter of fact, when I heard that there was this story that Mr. Spielberg had it, you know, Steven's talking about doing a Cold War story about Francis Gary Powers. And I said, well, I know who Francis Gary Powers is. What is it going to be? You know, is this going to be, you know, Checkpoint Charlie and phones ringing and guys in fedoras smoking cigarettes? And kind of came out that. But then upon reading it, and I did not read Matthew Sharman's draft. I was saying, well, I'd love to read that. And they said, well, wait, because the Coens are turning in a new draft. And when I read the Coen brothers draft, it was right off the bat. I was saying, how come I don't know this? And very quickly, I did a little bit of research and found out really how authentic the story that they were telling was.
This is your fourth collaboration with Steven Spielberg, our former editor, for one glorious issue.
Really? Really?
Didn't give me a pay rise. Can you believe that?
Well, does the editor have that ability, or is that the publisher?
No, that's the editor.
Well, I'm going to root for it. You know.
That's two votes, you and me. So when Steven wants to make a movie with you, does he simply call up and go, okay, Tom, let's go. Me and you, Bridge of Spies, let's make it happen. Or is the process slightly more involved than that?
Well, when there's an actual screenplay involved, I get sort of like a call saying, hey, look, I got this thing and I think it's really interesting. And it comes along. Now, it's going to be tilted in a direction if it's coming from Steven. You might have the natural proclivity to think, boy, I really hope I like this thing. And I really hope I work it out. I will tell you that the four movies that we made, Saving Private Ryan, I never read any version of it that wasn't officially from Steven. For The Terminal, actually, that script had existed that I was working on it with Sasha Gervasi, who is the screenwriter, and it had gone through a couple of iterations. And then Steven read it and said, boy, I'd really like to do this. Mm-hmm. So that was the opposite. They were working on Catch Me If You Can with Leo, and I read the screenplay as a writing sample of, I think, Mr. Nathanson, who wrote it. Mm-hmm. And I crashed that movie.
You just turned up on set one day.
Well, no. What happened was I read it and I knew that Leo was going to be playing a Frank Abagnale. And when I read it, the character at that time, it was called Joe Shea, but Carl Hanred, the FBI guy, I called up and said, look, I'm not trying to crash anything and I'm not trying to stick my head in this, but you have a part in here that is the equal to Javert in Les Miserables. You can't have a movie called Catch Me If You Can without somebody who is constantly chasing him. I'd like to play who's constantly chasing him because, as I said, you can't cut him. You're always going to have to cut back to the guy who is chasing the hero. So I horned in on that all on my own. So there you have all those various permutations. And Leo gave the okay, and Steven let me in. But it literally, I said, look, I'm not trying to horn in. It's got to be okay with Leo. So Leo said, oh, yeah, sure. So that's how that became the three-hander that it was. And on this case, it was just, you know, I heard about it, and I didn't do anything, and I didn't read it until Steven said, look, I think this is really great. And we compare notes on all sorts of history anyway. We're always, you know, sending each other photographs or stuff off the internet, or, you know, we'll have screenings of documentaries that we fall in love with. Mm-hmm. And that was that. And he, you know, he told me that he was always thinking of me as James Donovan. So, hey, man, looks like I got invited to a damn good dance.
In the 10 years between The Terminal and this movie, had you come close to working together?
Well, we always have had this storytelling bond because we have produced a bunch of long-form television miniseries that definitely have a different sort of work dynamic than me being an actor in one of his films. But that means we get to have, like for where we did Band of Brothers, that came about very quickly right after we did Saving Private Ryan. We made it happen pretty quickly. But The Pacific, those take 3, 4, 5 years in order to get up. And it means we get together and talk about what fascinates us and the story beats that we're going to try to incorporate into these big things. So I think I have a working relationship now that is him that is based on sweat and anxiety on my side, because you don't want to go to work in the morning and have Steven Spielberg disappointed in the work you did, or somehow regretting the fact that he cast you in it. I actually think I think I work harder for Steven now than I did than the first time.
Take nothing for granted.
You can't. Yeah. You know, here's the interesting thing about all the movies that I've done with Steven. I will say that Everybody has something fascinating to do. Even the day players, the people who only come in for one day and only work one day, Stephen will want them to come in with a great idea, and he will be empowered by stuff that they come in and want to do. And if you take a look at Bridge of Spies, which has, you know, a number of friends of mine that were in it from other jobs, I have to say it's extraordinary that everybody has something interesting to do. No one just comes in, hands over a telegram, and then walks out. Everybody has a unique sort of character tidbit that they get to play out. And it makes for the better tapestry of the movie.
It's been a while since you were a day player, if indeed you ever were.
I've had a couple of weekly contracts.
Did you show up with ideas, or what was that situation like?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you have to. I mean, and I got together with Mark Rylance before we started shooting, and all of the guys who play as agents. And I said, guys, this is what I know about the boss. He will have an idea of where the camera is going to be, but everything else he's looking for is coming. He wants to be inspired by everybody. So let's be armed for bear, as the case may be. In regards to this, I was lucky that James Donovan wrote as much about his life as he did. He did a very long book about the whole entire case with Rudolph Abel that I got an awful lot of things from, although it's not the major part of the film. I got a lot of the relationship that he had with Rudolph Abel from that. But he also wrote a very microscopic examination of the 6 days that he was in Berlin negotiating the spy swap. And I got a ton of small little details, including the cold. When I came in, I said, you know, boss, he caught a vicious cold on the plane ride over in an uninsulated, unheated military aircraft. And so for the first 4 days he was in Berlin, he was miserable. And he said, that's great. You'll start with a cold and you'll give Hoffman the cold. He'll have it by the time you go home. And so that's an example of what he will do with some idea you might have.
How hard is it to convincingly convey a cold on screen?
Well, you have to go there a little bit. And you have there's a nasal spray that you just keep pushing. It's not pleasant. But, you know, you work it out with keep pulling out the handkerchief. It's very hard to fake a sneeze. Fake sneeze is really usually an obvious thing.
Coughing's quite easy, I imagine. But
you can always cough. But then there's that, you know, the empty-headedness, you know, that kind of thing. I say, look, I'll do a little bit, but you guys are going to have to do something with the EQ and the mix in order to give me that, you know, that congested head sound.
There's also something else that really intrigued me about. There's just a little character note that I really, really liked, which is that when James Donovan says a number, he tends to repeat it. He goes one, 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 several times throughout the movie. Did that come from the book, or was that something you?
No, that was the Coens. One of those kind of things that the Coen brothers bring into it. They write dialogue the way I describe it as it scans, almost like literature, or, you know, like Shavian dialogue, like George Bernard Shaw or Shakespeare. It has a cadence, and it has a logic to it, so that every character sounds very different from the other characters. Yeah. It's not like people have a unified style. And they wrote that. They wrote the 111s and the 222s and the 333s. And I realized, well, that's a negotiating skill. That's a tool. That's a trick that he uses in order to win the day or get his point over. And you just take that and you run with stuff like that. That's what you look for in a screenplay.
It's amazing. So you still call Stephen the boss?
Or mon général, El Jefe. I got a lot of nicknames for it. It's funny because I like to get to the set early. I like to be done as ready as I can and get to the set while they're still setting up. And with Janusz, his DP, and I now know Mitch Dubin, who's been his camera operator. So four movies, I know a lot of the people, and he's worked with a lot of the same posts. And we're all saying, okay, so we're going to be here, we're going to be this, da, da, da. And the question comes around, we say, okay, well, that's about as much as we could do till the boss gets here. Well, let's see what the boss says about this, because you know, you're not going to do anything unless he says, don't do that there, do that over there, save that for later, we're going to do something else. He is the boss. The director's always the boss. But there's a lot of, you know, oh great one, you know, you can say things like that. Hey, Mr. Smarty Pants, that comes up every now and again. Hey, Mr. Smarty Pants, are we gonna flip this at the end? Are we just gonna go around, or are you gonna pull back? Are you gonna flip a lens or what?
but you can't go straight in with a Mr. Smartypants. You have to know the man for several years.
You got to get there.
Day player, day one. Mr. Smartypants,
not good. I wouldn't recommend anybody walking in for a first meeting and saying to Stephen, well, aren't you Mr. Smartypants? I would recommend El Jefe or O Great Exalted Leader. You can always try that.
Fair enough. Over the 10 years of Stephen and you have been making movies apart, have there been any roles that you have coveted that he has directed? For example, you know, if you called him up and going, yeah, I could be Lincoln. I could be Indiana Jones.
No, Indiana Jones, yeah. Maybe. No, that's kind of ticking. No, but you know, he actually plays the nature of what he's going to be doing pretty close to the vest. There has been some stuff that he sent to me or I've sent to him, but they're just germs of ideas or they're things that are so far down the pike that part of the question is well, if this becomes something, would you be interested in it? And there's some stuff that is kind of like I take off the table right off the bat. Maybe because my combo plate is pretty full sometimes.
Sure.
But also this, I wouldn't know what to do with it. But when, like, for example, we will be collaborating again on a big miniseries about the air war. And that came about because HBO came back to us and said, would you guys like to give us another chapter in the sort of Band of Brothers saga, the Band of Brothers in the Pacific. Hmm. And my first question was, do you really want it? And they say, yeah, it's working out pretty good. I said, well, let me talk to the boss and see what he has to say about it. So we get together and we just begin to start noodling stuff that won't come to fruition for another 3 or 4 years.
Oh, wow. I can't talk to you without talking about my favorite Tom Hanks film.
Which one is?
The Burbs.
Oh, my Lord. Really? Burbs.
It really is.
Interesting little suburban nightmare there.
Yeah.
No, that was fun. Yeah. It was fun. It was a story about a guy that should have gone on vacation. That's when I was talking to Joe Dante at the beginning of it, I said, okay, this is not a story about horrible things. This is a story about a man who should have packed the car and driven away from his house. He's got 2 weeks off, and if he stays home, he's going to be driven absolutely insane. Mm-hmm. It was a fun movie because we made it in the summertime at Universal Studios on the back lot. You know, it's actually what became known as Wisteria Lane on Desperate Housewives.
Desperate Housewives, yeah.
That was the same spot, literally the same houses that we used for the film. And it was a great group of people, and we laughed an awful lot. And we had, I don't know, here's a little background about making movies. There's a schedule that's called splits. Mm-hmm. It says, you want to make every movie you can shooting the schedule called splits, because what that means is you go into work about noon or 1 o'clock and you shoot during the daylight hours. Mm-hmm. And then that's the first half of the day. And the second half of the day is for darkness. And so you have to wait for darkness. So you shoot until you lose the light for shooting the day. And then you have about 2.5 hours off while they're moving the condors and the lights into place and they're waiting for the sun to go down so they can shoot the night shoots. And then you leave about midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning. And it's the absolute best way in order to, you get enough sleep. Sleep, you see your family, you have a nice 2 hours off about in the middle of the day. Yeah. And if you're making like a gang comedy, it's an awfully good hang in order to hang out.
There's one thing I wanted to ask you about specifically in The Burbs. I don't know if you remember this, but towards the end, after the house is blown up and there's chaos reigns everywhere, you appear at the top of a small flight of steps.
Oh, and I come down, the way I come down the stairs.
It's one of the greatest bits of physical comedy I've ever seen. How did you, I look at that and I still marvel at how you did that.
I know exactly what you're talking about. And I was talking to Joe and I was trying to physicalize the shock waves that were still going through his head. Mm-hmm. And the stairs were there. And quite frankly, I don't think I could do that today without twisting an ankle. But I would like to give myself some degree of credit. I think I was so much in the moment of being shell-shocked and being nearly blown up that there's a stoop and there's about 5 or 6 steps that lead down to the walk. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of like flop my feet down them as opposed to taking any
almost like a human slinky in a way. You just...
Yeah. I was a younger man. I was a younger man, and I had stronger calf muscles in those days. But I know exactly what you're talking about. And luckily, I only had to do it like 3 or 4 times, because I have a feeling I probably could have done some ligament damage on take 8. But as it was, I think we only had to go up to take 4.
Well, thank you for clearing something up that's been in my mind for a long, long time. I just want to ask you very, very quickly what you're doing next. I mean, obviously, you're still working on... on Sully?
I have, yes. Clint Eastwood is directing me in Sully, which is a story about the pilot who landed the plane on the Hudson and saved everybody's life. I also finished The Inferno with Ron Howard, which is another Robert Langdon Da Vinci Code Dan Brown story. We shot that in Florence and in Budapest. I did a week on a movie that my company is producing called The Circle that James Ponsoldt directed along with the fabulous Emma Watson. And I did a film about a year and a half ago. I did a movie based on another Dave Eggers novel called Hologram for the King with Tom Tickfer, who was one of the co-directors of Cloud Atlas and who also did Run, Lola, Run. So I've got a lot of stuff that has yet to come out.
Busy man. Are you finished on Toy Story 4? Have you finished
The Toy Story movies go on and on and on. You go in about every 4 months and do a little bit more recording. And that's now not coming out until, I believe, 88. So I'll be working on that for the next 2 years.
Wow. Okay. And is it a rom-com?
Toy Story? It's a romantic adventure, man. It's there is some relationship dynamics that go down between Woody and Bo Peep. No lie. Intriguing. Woody and Bo Peep. Look for it now.
I cannot wait to see it. Tom Hanks, has been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Great pleasure. Lovely
talking
to you.
Tom Hanks there. Yeah, he was as Tom Hanksy as you could possibly dream. It was amazing. And to finally, that question about the Burbs, to get that answer about, I was in dreamland. He was wearing his Sully hair.
Even better.
Which meant he was like dressed as a big blue monster.
Hey, it's not even his Pixar character, you ages. Let's move on.
Shall we? Let's talk about reviews. We've got quite a lot to get through this week. Let's start with Bridge of Spies. Steven Spielberg reunited with Tom Hanks to tell a Cold War thriller based on a true story with a script by the Coen brothers. Yes.
Co-written, I think it was.
Co-written, yes.
They sort of retouched an earlier draft.
They did. Matt Charman, a British writer, wrote the initial draft, and then the Coen brothers came in and went, "Hey, we're going to do it, we're doing it." And then,
I'm not sure that's what they sound like.
That's what they do.
That's their creative process. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hey, what's the rumpus?
So it's 1957 in the movie. Not right now. The Cold War is in full swing, and an artist played by Mark Rylance, called Rudolf Abel, is arrested on charges of spying for the Soviet Union. So the Americans want to showcase the fact that they're giving him due process without really 100% really going to town on the whole justice thing. So they line up a lawyer called James Donovan, who's played by Hanks, to defend him. A short time afterwards, he's convicted anyway. A short time afterwards, a U-2 pilot called Francis Gary Powers, played by Austin Stowell, crash lands in the Soviet Union. And basically, the Americans are very keen, obviously, to get him back. And the Russians are equally keen to get Abel back. So there is the sort of the setup for a deal. But nobody can be seen to be dealing with each other on this. So Donovan is dispatched to Cold War Berlin to try and negotiate a prisoner exchange. That's the basic setup. Yeah.
Obviously, there's a bit more to it than that as well. There's some complications and whatnot. But
Very much so.
Yeah, this is the antithesis. This is the sixth spy movie of the year, following on from Kingsman, Spy, Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, Spectre, and The Man from U.N.C.L.E. And it's a complete antithesis, I would say, of all those films. This is the emphasis here is on dialogue and brain power rather than people pointing guns at each other and clinging on to the sides of planes, which is amazing, has its place. But
yeah, Ian Nathan's review has said it's Atticus Finch trying to do George Smiley, which is actually pretty spot on, because the closest analogy to this one is Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy in recent years, in the sense that the tension comes from men talking in rooms. And they are incredibly tense scenes, but it's not, you know, running for the wall or driving a car over it or, you know, zip lining over it like they did in Man from U.N.C.L.E. It's a very mature, grown-up film. You can feel the cold coming off the screen, you know. It's Janusz Kaminski again, but it's just he's got that sort of paranoia flavour of the kind of the great Cold War films. He's got that sort of almost a little touch of The Third Man about it, you know. It's cold, it's wet, it's miserable. Donovan isn't having a very nice time, but he's a very sharp guy. He's very good at what he does, and he just goes and does it. And it's sort of brilliant, actually.
There's some amazing performances in this film.
Yeah.
I think Tom Hanks, I mean, you know, he's Tom Hanks. He's utterly reliable. He's just a safe pair of hands. It's not a showy performance.
No, not at all.
It's not bombastic. It's very mature and sort of very restrained. I think Mark Rylance, for me, is the star of this film. I think he is like the heart of this film. He's incredible. He's so understated. But in that understatement, he brings this amazing sort of humanity to what could be a very easy villain, I suppose.
Yeah. I think it's interesting because he's been this huge star on stage for years now. If you were lucky enough to see Jerusalem, like, he'll have blown you away in that, for example. And he's only just breaking through, really, on screen. There was, obviously, Wolf Hall last year on TV, and now this. I feel like it's finally kind of beginning to work for him.
Let's not forget The Gunman, in which he...
He
was in that.
Yeah, we could try and forget it, actually. But no, it's a good cast across the board, as you would expect, because who doesn't want to work with Steven Spielberg? And it's just underplayed, brilliantly tense, I think, and just really interesting. I think it's really interesting in what it says about the world now as much as the world at the time of the Cold War, and what it says about America now as opposed to the time of the Cold War. It's a really, really fascinating film. I loved it.
Yeah, it's really good. Great performances all round. Spielberg magic. It's a very slow film,
yeah,
I think, which is a very interesting thing. It's not the kinetic Spielberg of the past, so don't go expecting incredible camera moves or set pieces, but I really like the script. The script's fantastic, and Hanks nails it. And you can see all those little Coen Brothers touches. I think Rylance is great. He's definitely going to be in the supporting actor race. We didn't talk about the fact that this week Creed opens in the States and seems to have crashed the Oscar race in a big way. We probably should talk about that in due course. But yeah, he's very, very good. I think Hanks is great in this. But the dialogue is fantastic. There's a little repeated motif all the way through. We talk about it in the Tom Hanks scene, but there's another one where, you know, Rudolf Abel just seems like the most laid-back, relaxed person in the world. He's facing near certain death or incarceration, and he just takes it on the chin at all times. And there's a repeated motif where Hanks keeps saying to him, you know, you don't look bothered by this. And Abel always replies, would it help? Which seems to me, and I don't know whether the Coen brothers wrote that line, but it feels very Coen-y.
It does.
And it's a nice mixture of the Coens and Spielberg. Good stuff. 4 stars for Bridge of Spies, which ordinarily would make it the film of the week.
This is quite a tough week, I'll
this
be honest.
This is a hell of a week. This is a very, very good week, because next up we got Todd Haynes' Oscar botherer, Carol. John, what do you make of this? Well, what's it about?
So Carol is a new film from Todd Haynes, who is a very good director who we know from Far From Heaven and I'm Not There. This is a sort of romantic period drama set in 1952 in New York City, and it stars Cate Blanchett and Rooney Mara. And it's sort of basically a love story of a love that dare not speak its name. It's set at a time when homosexuality is obviously very much frowned upon, essentially illegal. And Cate Blanchett plays this housewife who embarks on a sort of illicit affair with Rooney Mara. And it's a very simple love story in many ways. It's, you know, they just have an affair, and Carol has to go through dealing with a broken marriage. But it's beautifully done. It's one of the most beautiful films I think I've seen this year. It's shot on Super 16mm, which gives this gorgeous, grainy quality. There's absolutely stunning cinematography. And it's just very sensitive and a very sort of thoughtful portrayal of love and romance. I spoke to Todd Haynes this week, actually, and he said, obviously, this is a very specific story about homosexuality before it was accepted in society, but there is a very universal story behind it, this sort of sexual awakening, this sort of exploration of love that I think speaks to a lot of people. And it's done in such a beautiful and a thoughtful way. I can't recommend it enough.
Yeah, it's absolutely fantastic, this.
Yeah.
I mean, and it, you know, it is a love story, but it unfolds so slowly that you actually have time to get involved with it yourself in a way, and very much root for the characters, and very much, you know, you basically, the tension in this film is everything going to be okay? Are these two, despite everything stacked against them, going to going to find a way to be together, because it is not clear for a very long time if they actually will. And certainly it's then not clear, you know, if they can find a way to stay together. So it's a really beautiful film, beautifully told. They sort of lift the framing device from a brief encounter. We sort of meet them late on and then kind of flash backwards, but it's absolutely fantastic film.
We should mention this is based on a novel by Patricia Highsmith, who created obviously the talented Mr. Ripley novels, but this is a very personal novel for her because it essentially, it's not entirely, but there's elements of an autobiographical nature in
very
the story.
Very much so, yeah.
Yeah, so the novel's The Price of Salt. And the performances in this are fantastic. Cate Blanchett obviously we take for granted, but Rooney Mara shared the Best Actress prize at Cannes back in May when this film first launched, and is equally fantastic.
She looks exactly like Audrey Hepburn at times. I mean, you know, she's obviously a beautiful woman at the best times, or the worst of times, but she looks absolutely stunning in this. And both of them, I would say, all credit as well to makeup and hair and costume as well by Sandy Powell, because they look incredible. If you are a lady watching this, I would really make sure that your lipstick game is on form before you go in, or you're going to come out feeling so scruffy. I certainly did. So, gentlemen, I guess brush your hair or whatever you do. I don't know.
So 4 stars for Carol. It's fantastic. Fine, I think, with Bridge of Spice for Film of the Week. A fantastic tale, as John said, of sexual awakening. And speaking of tales of sexual awakening, it's The Good Dinosaur.
Oh, God.
Which is...
Not speaking of sexual awakening.
No, of course not.
No.
Which is Pixar's Pixar's second movie this year. Because Pixar movies are like London buses. You wait ages for one. Then two come along at once. They cost millions to produce, and loads of people get on board. So what's this one about? And following in the wake of course, the brilliant Inside Out.
This one is a simpler story in a lot of ways. So it's set in a world where the asteroid that killed the dinosaurs didn't. And so a few million years later, they've evolved into sort of, at least to develop farming. That's as much as we really see here. And a little family of dinosaurs live on a little farm. And there's 3 kids in the family. 2 of them are very bold and outgoing and you know, tough little kids. And Arlo, the youngest, is a big old scaredy cat. And unfortunately, it is Arlo one day who is swept off downriver when he falls accidentally into the river that runs by their house and ends up a very, very long way from home. And the only thing with him is this little, what he calls a critter, but it's a little, essentially a boy. And in this world, humans have not developed high faculties yet. He's a little bit more intelligent than a dog, maybe. But he runs around on 4 legs. And he basically, Arlo adopts him essentially as a pet. And then the two of them try to make their way home. So it's a very kind of A to B story in a lot of ways. There's a lot of charm in this, as you would expect of Pixar. You know, there's the two characters, the bond between them kind of grows from something like hatred to begin with, because Arlo, you know, blames this critter for a lot of the stuff that's gone wrong. His name is Spot, by the way, the little boy. but it kind of grows to be a mutual respect and a mutual affection and a real true friendship, as Pixar is so known for. They're also great little kind of characters along the way. There's a weird sort of a stegosaurus type creature who's like got all these little other animals living on his horns, and he's this weird kind of slightly trippy kind of shamanic figure. There is a scene where they actually get drunk and then have a hangover on fermented berries by accident, which is a weird thing to see in a Pixar movie. There's also some T-Rex cowboys, one of whom is voiced by Sam Elliott. And there's some gorgeous little touches there. You've got to admire the way that the T-Rexes, they kind of sit very upright as if they're riding a horse, but they're obviously just being a T-Rex. And they say hya, and I was kind of like, who are you hya-ing? Is it your own legs?
That's right. They're whipping themselves.
They're whipping themselves, yeah, into a frenzy as well.
That's really good.
But I mean, there are so many just gorgeous little touches to this film. You know, there's a bit where there's sort of what looks like upside down shark fins coming through low hanging cloud. It's one of the most gorgeous shots of the year until you figure out what exactly is going on. I have never seen water animated better. I have never seen more gorgeous landscapes. This has just a laundry list of beautiful, beautiful moments in it. I think the problem is that landscape feels much more developed and much more sophisticated than the story taking place in front of it. And you have essentially a cartoon dinosaur. You know, he's a very blobby, bright green looking creature, and he doesn't have the sophistication that we maybe expect from Pixar, especially coming straight after Inside Out.
Yeah, I think we were treated to a fairly high bar with Inside Out. I think that was such a sophisticated and just brilliant movie. And this is a much more simple story. And we know that it did have a few production troubles, that it was...
Very much so, yeah.
The original director was replaced and they essentially had to restart from scratch only about a year ago. Mm-hmm. And you do see a little bit some of those troubles on screen, just in terms of how the story doesn't feel quite finished and perhaps the characters aren't quite developed enough. But I still love this film. I think this is another, you know, fantastic entry from Pixar. As you say, it is one of the most beautiful bits of animation I think we've ever seen. I was half expecting David Attenborough to be commentating at some point. The landscapes, the scenery is just, I mean, it's porn for your eyes. It's lovely. Porn for your eyes? Does that really work?
Well, if it's porn, is porn the themes for your of eyes, sexual awakening.
Only in your head, Chris. But no, it is. I mean, it's a lesser Pixar, but it's still a Pixar,
yes.
And therefore it gets, you know, a lot right. There are elements here. There are little echoes of Ice Age, and there are little echoes of How to Train Your Dragon, especially in one scene involving some sticks and drawing in sand. But that's not to take away from the rest of it, which is very good. So we give it 3 stars.
Which is, of course,
a recommendation.
Indeed. Lesser Pixar.
Yeah.
Okay.
But still Pixar.
But yeah. Still Pixar, which is good. Okay, so this is going to be interesting. The last film of the week that we're going to discuss got 4 stars from Empire Magazine. In fact, from me. But Helen doesn't like it.
Nope.
So, it's Black Mass.
Yeah, it is.
Have at it.
So, Black Mass, this is the new film from Scott Cooper, who we mentioned earlier. It's about an FBI agent called John Connolly, played by Joel Edgerton. He grew up in Southie, which we know from all those Matt and Ben films.
Boston.
And he grew up near a Boston gangster called Whitey Bulger, who's played by Johnny Depp. He wasn't really friends with Bulger. He was friends with his older brother, who's Billy Bulger, who's played by Benedict Cumberbatch. Because you see Cumberbatch and Depp and you think, yes, those two were born to play siblings. Anyway, Billy Bulger is a very respectable figure, a state politician, very, very well-to-do and well-respected. Whitey, not so much. He's, you know, he's already been in Alcatraz by the time we meet him. He is not a nice man. But Edgerton sees an opportunity to basically bring Whitey in as a sort of informant, to use him to undo some of the bigger mob figures in the city. And Whitey sees this as an opportunity to get rid of some of his enemies and manipulate the FBI into essentially doing his dirty work for him. Mm-hmm. So it seems a match made in heaven. Mm-hmm. But of course, things don't work out terribly well for all concerned.
I should say this is based, of course, on a true story.
It is very much based on a true story. Absolutely.
Yes. Whitey Bulger was one of the inspirations for, I believe, Jack Nicholson's character in The Departed.
I believe the case. Yes. Yeah. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Where should we start?
I mean,
I like this film. I gave it 4 stars.
You should probably start then.
Do you want me to say why I gave it 4 stars?
Yeah, I do.
It was in focus. That's always good. That's a star in itself. Well, what I thought was interesting about this movie was that there's a really cliched gangster movie here. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it's based on a true story doesn't immediately excuse it from being cliched. There's a scene, and I start my review with this. There's a scene where Whitey and some of his crew drive along, get out, walk along, you know, to this really deserted, barren part of Boston. Chat. Guy's running his mouth off, and then he doesn't see it coming, but the audience do. He gets popped in the head. And we've seen this in 1,000 gangster films. We've seen it in 1,000 gangster movies, and many of them are better than the gangster movie in Black Mass. That's not what interested me about the film. What interested me about the film was that that's as cliched as it gets. From that point on, it turns into more, I think, John Connolly's story, the Joel Edgerton story of a cop who, well, sorry, of an FBI agent who's in way over his head and who's seduced by the dark side of the force. Poor old Uncle Owen, he gets seduced by the dark side of the force, and I thought that was really interesting, a wrinkle that we hadn't seen before. And I thought that that side of the film was very, very good. The relationship between Whitey Bulger and John Connolly and Edgerton is fantastic, and I think another nailed on best supporting actor Oscar nominee for his performance in this. Mm-hmm. And that aspect of the film I thought was great. And the performances are very, very good.
Well, that aspect of the film, I'm with you. But my problem is I didn't think that was the thrust of the story, and it certainly wasn't enough of the focus of the story. Because I think that Scott Cooper essentially tried to have his cake and eat it by telling that interesting story we haven't seen before, the FBI agent who gets corrupted by his own informant, and watered it down by also focusing equally, if not more so, on this gangster story. And it may be true, that doesn't mean it isn't something we've seen before, because all of those beats have been done better in Goodfellas, basically, in the Whitey Bulger story. I mean, Johnny Depp, you know, Whitey Bulger doesn't actually look that much like that, so it's a little bit, he went to a very extreme with his look, and it doesn't...
According to Scott Cooper, who I interviewed for the film, he does look a lot like that. In real life, people saw Johnny Depp and thought, oh my God, Whitey Bulger's just walked back in the room. But I think, and I, again, this is something to talk about in the review, I think he is too realistic in a way. It's over the top a little bit. And I think that what they're trying to do in this movie is portray Whitey Bulger as the devil. And I think... which
yes,
is part-
but if you're going to do that, I think you should do that in a smaller dose. Because there's too much attention given to Whitey Bulger as a character and his personal dilemmas if he is a demonic figure. That's a point of balance that the movie didn't hit for me. Mm. If he is essentially this sort of, you know, demonic tempter figure, and there are a couple of scenes where they almost succeed in doing that, then great. But then you don't also need. But then you don't also need all these stories about his concerns and his traumas and his worries and how he's trying to deal with all of those, because that undermines any sort of devilish persona. It's just, it didn't balance up for me. I had the same problem with Out of the Furnace, which I thought was just profoundly missing its own story. It hadn't developed its own plot enough, and I thought this had exactly the same problem.
Well,
but in terms of everyone...
But I will say that Johnny Depp was on first. So it's a Whitey Bulger film before Scott Cooper came onto it.
Sure.
And I think he, as a director, was probably more excited by the John Connolly stuff as well. And I think it's really interesting. You watch how John Connolly's world seems to cave in on him as the net tightens around him, how he changes, how his personality changes, how his look changes. Joel Edgerton's hair seems to get even more towering as the movie progresses. It sounds like, you know, you really didn't like the film, Helen, but I thought that it was Johnny Depp's really interesting in the role. He's very good in the role, but I think I came out of it and I saw it with someone, and I came out of it and they went, his look took me out of the film.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're aware you're watching Johnny Depp wearing the most piercing blue eyes I've seen on screen since Meg Foster, and it's kind of just, it's a little bit discomforting, and it does remind you that you're watching the performance, which of course is always the case with movies.
But I think everybody's in that doughy makeup as well.
But he has a little, Edgerton gets away with it, I think, and Cumberbatch gets away with it also. I think, you know, they age quite subtly over the course of the film, which takes place over about 20 years or so.
I'm thinking more of
Jesse Clemens.
Yes, exactly. You know, he looks doughy from the word go, and I could understand if they were aging him up, but the aging makeup is... I think the makeup all around is distracting. I think that's true. Mm. I mean, I didn't actually have a problem with Johnny Depp's performance. I just had a problem with... The character. You needed about 10% of those scenes, and this would have been a really strong film. If you'd had 10% of those, maybe 30% more Joel Edgerton, that would work. I also think, like, Billy Bulger is a more interesting character in many ways than Whitey Bulger. How do you become a politician like that with a brother like he had? That's a fascinating story. But just another gangster, I don't care.
If Johnny Depp, the film is set in front of me, and the performances are set in front of me, and I think you're right. I think the Joel Edgerton, John Connolly stuff is way more interesting than Whitey Bulger stuff. But it's not like that stuff is terrible. A lot of it we may have seen before, but I think it's pulled off very nicely. It's a very interesting immorality tale. I think the performances are excellent across the board. It has a real sense of character and place. I thought I liked it.
Okay, well, agree to disagree.
But I know that a lot of people don't. This is interesting because I know a lot of people don't. Well, a lot of people, I've seen a lot of American critics as well, like, criticize the accents. The accents seemed okay to me. I don't know.
Yeah, I think I actually saw it up near Boston at the time, and I saw it the day before I saw Spotlight, which I think has a better sense of place and that sort of slightly insular Boston community, and, you know, the fact that everybody knows everybody and the sort of the Southie mentality, I think, comes across a bit more in Spotlight even. And even there, Spotlight's been criticized for not playing that up enough. So I thought, you know, there's the one scene where he, Johnny Depp's character, meets the little old lady who sort of, and he's very nice to her and very considerate because she lives in the neighbourhood. There's scenes like that that give you some idea of what this is and why Connolly might be so pleased to be in this guy's orbit. But there's just, I don't know, there's not enough of it for me.
I thought you would like it. It's about two old childhood friends and one's with them to the end of the line and all that sort of stuff.
I'm just not emotionally ready for next June, okay?
You're not ready for Black Mass Civil War.
Oh, God.
Get ready for that. Okay, then, Black Mass, I gave it 4 stars. Empire gave it 4 stars. Helen, what would you give it?
I would probably give it 2.
2 stars. All right. 4 plus 2 divided by 2 equals 3 stars. So 3 stars for Black Mass, which is, as we always say in the podcast, a recommendation. There they go. We got there in the end.
Uh-huh.
All good. That's it for this week's Empire podcast. We should have arguments more often than the podcast.
Oh,
I think
lovely.
It's so lovely to argue with you.
Chris and Helen, Civil War.
Choose a side. Don't choose a side, because loads of people will choose Helen. Join us next week for more film related fun. We will be joined by another ruddy bloody legend.
Who's that?
Lily Tomlin.
No, awesome.
Very excited about that.
Will she be coming in 9 to 5? We'll certainly be doing big business on that one.
I'm leaving.
I'll say, hey, Lily, why not take all of me? I'll say, as she's,
leaving. Please stop.
Lily Tomlin. Until then, it's goodbye from John.
Cheerio, bye.
It's goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
And it's goodbye for me. I'm off to the States.
Oh, really?
And I'm going to track down Mark Holton. And I'm going to point at him. You know what I'm going to say?
What?
Hey! It's Enrico Palazzo!
It's the last thing I would have expected.
I know. Amazing. See you next week.